theme today is the implications of the other. And my name is Molefe Tsele. Earlier, I was battling whether should I also rephrase this theme as otherness, sameness, and humanness as a way of trying to define, to get the meaning of why are we concerned with these implications of the other in the first place. The fact that ultimately what we are concerned about is getting to know more about ourselves as human beings. That is why I said the tension between otherness, sameness, and humanness. And as this continues, you would see that my major concern is what is it that can make us more human in the midst of the diversity that exists. In other words, would it have been better for us, or would it have been better if we were living in a situation where everybody is like us, where there is sameness? Does the fact that there is the other in our midst make any meaning to who we are? That is why the theme is the implications of the other to us. And it is a follow-up, an immediate follow-up to our discussion on the issue of race and culture, where we traced the roots of race being that tendency when one interact with a group that is unlike him, that tendency to take a superior position to that group of people who is unlike us, whether that group could be that difference could be based on religion, color, gender, linguistic differences, geographic differences, physical facial appearances, etc. But the fact that there is that lack of sameness. And I think it's an important problem these days when we are no longer living in a homogeneous world or society, where whether we like it or not, we are going to be confronted with the other. Now, you will see that as I develop this, I'm going to move far from the other as a group, another group, to more of the other as another person. Could be just another person who is the same like you, in the sense of being also an American, or the other is the same person in the same sense of being another woman, but simply by being the other. What is the implications of the other to us? That is going to be part of what we will try to develop. Ordinarily, we go about our lives. When we conduct our lives, we make our choices in terms of their relevance to our interests. To which extent do I make this choice of coming to Holden in terms of contributing to me? I think that we can't help it. It is part of how we are constituted as human beings, that we make our choices in life in terms of the extent to which they are relevant to us. Such interests, which we say those interests are relevant to us, may be personal interests, may be joint interests in terms of my family or my marriage. I may not personally be interested in coming to Holden Village, but if my wife and children are interested, it becomes also part of an interest that I pursue. for that matter, actually, they can also be in terms of national interest. as a nation, as a community, as a country, we do conduct our lives. Otherwise, if we were not doing that in terms of perceived interests, the entire way of living will be so chaotic that you would actually not even know what is going to happen the next day. Someone who is similar to us comes across to us as less threatening, even if he actually is a competitor to us, to our these interests, because we can deal with that person. We know that if I'm a businessman, I encounter another businessman, we know the rules of the game, I can deal with him. But if I encounter a completely different person, then that becomes the case. And that is why when we are confronted with what is unlike, what is not, what is other, when that other challenges our choices and our interests, what I'm going to call, as we go through this lesson, our center of meaning, the whole system of which gives meaning to our lives, also comes called into question whenever we're confronted with the other. Our center of meaning also is called into question. Now, as I said, that the sub-theme of this discussion today is otherness, sameness, and humanness in the sense of personhood. What is it, therefore, this is what my second point, what is it that actually constitutes us as people or as persons? What is it that I can say makes me a person? I know that this is really a theoretical and to some extent also a philosophical question, but I think it's important that we follow it within this context of race and culture. How is the self constituted as a person? Now, some people say that the self is constituted as a person at that moment when it encounters another person. In isolation of all of other people, of other persons, of other selves, I cannot even know that I'm a person, or I cannot even become a person. I am constituted as a person at that moment when I encounter other persons, or what do we call other selves. Tillich says, I quote, "Personal life emerges in the encounter of person with person and in no other way." That's what theologian Paul Tillich says. In African languages, we've got a proverb which summarizes what we call humanist philosophy. It says, "Umuntu ngumuntu ngabantu," or in Setswana, as my sister then knows Setswana, it says, "Motho ke motho ka batho." Can you just translate it if you know?
A person is person
through or by other
people.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's actually what, if you look at it, it's common sense. It simply means that the fact that you are existing is because some people made you to exist. We are born through other people. Otherwise, if you were not born by other person, you wouldn't be a person. Maybe you'd be something else, a superhuman or an angel or something. But if you are to be a person, it implies that you are that. That is why Paul Tillich, as I say, says that personal life emerges in the encounter with persons and in no other way. Now, my encounter with other persons is not only essential for my achievement of personhood. It also implies, I do not only discover myself as a person when I encounter other persons, but it also implies something which is very important. It also implies an unconditional command to acknowledge the other whom I encounter as a person like me, as a center of meaning, having its own dignity and integrity. Otherwise, then I do not encounter that person as a person. That is why another Jewish philosopher contrasted this encounter of persons or of selves and said that the I is constituted when it encounters other people as I's or as you, in the I or I-you. And the moment you do not encounter that person, you are not confronted by the dignity and integrity of that other as a person, you simply encounter him as an it. And so there is this relationship of either I or I-you relationship or an I-it relationship, whether you reduce that person to a lower plane or lower level of a person. The argument seems to be that I as a person can achieve centeredness only in the interaction with others who also are persons. If I interact with others who are not themselves person, I cannot achieve centeredness. For an example, if it can a true interaction at the level of persons occur in a relationship of inequality, say for example a slave master relationship, that is debatable. It depends the extent to which these people perceive themselves. If the master looks at the slave as a person who has rights, who has a dignity, who has integrity, then that relationship of persons will exist. But if he looks at him as a person who really wouldn't even question him, then that won't happen. So the interaction won't happen between persons. Won't be that interaction of persons if there is no equality. For an example, it is assumed that in order for a marriage to be an interaction of equal partners, the two partners must really be, must accept one another at the level of persons. If the other one looks at the other as more lower or something, or as not so much as a person who confronts and challenges him, then that marriage won't be a marriage of equal partnership. It will be another companionship to achieve certain goals, etc. It could be to have children or what, but it will be a completely different thing to what is supposed to be a marriage. So an essential condition for the realization and maintenance of my being as a person is that I enter into relationships with other persons. Thus, the dynamics of my personhood, what is it that makes me a person, binds me to an unconditional obligation to act with full regard to the personhood of the other whom I encounter. If I've got to remain a person myself, there is this unconditional obligation to regard the other whom I encounter also as a person. Otherwise, that in itself may actually reverse and threaten my own perception as a person. That is why other people say that you cannot treat the other whom you encounter as less than a person, and not corrupt yourself in return, in reverse. That actually what you do to the other person, whether you treat him, it immediately reflects on you, and it says something about your own perception of your own personhood. Now, so far I've spoken about the way we encounter the person at a personal level, and it sounds as if that encounter is a natural, peaceful encounter, whereas in true reality, when you encounter the other, especially the other who is not like you, that encounter is conflict ridden. It has some conflicts within it, in the sense that there is some sizing up and you try to see to which extent can you stand your ground with this person whom you are encountering. I don't know how many of you have found themselves in that situation where you meet somebody, you are introduced to somebody, and you immediately begin in that minute encounter, you immediately to see yourself, is this person threatening? How can you stand, even at the level where you're just being introduced and you greet one another, but somehow you tend, the encounter is not just a peaceful thing. It's like some people say that in an encounter with the other, you automatically go to you retrieve your masks and immediately put your mask as a defense. And then you will speak in a honorable manner. You won't be yourself. The fact of the matter is that you won't be. You will, for example, you speak formally. How are you? Whereas if you are already used to that person, you will take off that mask and you will begin to not only smile, but you can even laugh in an uncontrollable manner at a crescendo. That shows that now you are no longer off guard. But ordinarily, the encounter between two people it discloses a situation of tragic conflict. And the conflict may be latent, but it is an underlying structural reality in any meeting between two centers, especially if these two people themselves are holding something. The other one is holding his own ground, the other is holding this ground. Then there is that conflict. Now, to which extent can you be open to somebody whom you just met? That openness involves making yourself vulnerable. You are opening yourself, you are saying, I am so and so, these are my weaknesses, these are my likes, these are my dislikes. Immediately that person knows you, and then because he knows you, can actually even abuse you. That is why there is one who would hide whatever thing that makes him vulnerable. And openness, true openness, is normally reserved to the other whom a person would say, well, I don't mind if this one takes advantage of my weakness or so. So the encounter is an encounter that happens in a situation of conflict, and that people immediately try to be on guard wherever they can. They put on masks, they put on defense mechanisms. Those could be anything that happens in their world as part of the way in which they could hold their ground against the other person who is completely different to them. Now, the second thing is that the encounter with the other also produces a sense of shock. It actually disorientate you in terms of it calls into question your own world or your own center of meaning. You cannot meet the other person and remain what you are without being challenged. Even at a very small intimate encounter of friends or of marriage partners, the effect of the matter is that their center of meaning, their world as they know it, becomes shaken a little bit in order to accommodate what the other values or prioritizes, etc., etc. And it becomes even more when you meet a complete stranger, a complete person who's unlike you in that sense. Now, but not only does it is the encounter conflict ridden, not only does it shake your world, it also opens up a new world of meaning to which you would otherwise have had no opportunity to know or to have access. To read and interpret others in terms of your own world and meaning and value is really to do them injustice. It is to reduce them to the sameness of which you are. And in order to do justice to them is to open yourself to their world. To say that this is how I understand marriage. And I do not, if I've got to understand how those people go about their things, let me open myself to their world. That is why one of the basic problems that has been there in the missionary encounter with other cultures is that invariably in most cases the missionaries were never open to the new world in which they were. Actually, they went with their own world and had this viewpoint to this world in which they encountered. And when they found, for example, different forms of courtships and of marriages, they immediately said, this is wrong, without putting themselves in that world. In other words, wanting these other people firstly to comply with the world that they were bringing. And it was much later that many missionaries began to realize that actually, by bringing to these people our own world, we destroyed their world and we failed to understand what is it that makes their marriage what it is. Why, for example, we had a seminar with a missionaries a few weeks ago at LSTC, and we're looking at the issue of marriage in an African cultural context where the phenomena of divorce is completely unknown, and we were asking why is that possible, and it was only when you understand marriage as not only a choice by consenting partners but also as a union of families, and once you understand that, you realize it was undoubtedly oppressive to some extent, especially when you view it in retrospect, but it was also a highly protected form of union in the sense that it was not easy to be abused. It was not easy to simply be all by yourselves, nobody understanding you to such an extent that you just feel, let me leave, because you always had this family. You are married into the family, and you cannot divorce a family, whole family. You can actually fight with your husband as one person, but you cannot really fight with all the people within that. Now, it is a different thing, and once you encounter that, and it opens you to a completely new world, and that is why I say that an encounter with the other has this thing that it opens you with a new world. Now, another important thing about an encounter with the other is that normally you do not encounter the other as your equal, but actually you can also encounter the other as lower than you. As one who has no position to bargain or negotiate a fair exchange, or as one who has no power to coerce me to give him his or her due. you encounter somebody as one who is completely dependent upon your goodwill and your well-being, as someone who is completely vulnerable. That is another reality of an encounter with the other person. You can have within this category of these people whom you encounter who are vulnerable, as a beggar, for an example, where you are not compelled to really do him, and he cannot say, I'm hungry, you have money, give me something. I mean, you are not really meeting at that level. He is at your mercy. You have got to decide whether you do something or you don't. But then, even there, where you encounter somebody who is vulnerable, who's weaker, he actually has an impact on you, because he actually reminds you of the power that you have as against what he doesn't have. And that simultaneously actually invokes on you some to question whether are you using this which you have responsibly? Do you have any responsibility for this? In other words, even when you encounter a person who is lower than you, that does not leave you as a person. It does not leave you unshaken, but it actually does something to you, in the sense that it reminds you that maybe God has given you something that he denied these other people. And therefore, what is the judgment that will come upon you if you fail to use that in the way that you're supposed to have used it? Now, around this, I would like to conclude up by something that happens to people when they encounter others, which is the tension between what is normally called egoism and altruism. Where in egoism we see the tendency to turn the other into a function of an essentially egoistic quest for self-actualization and self-interest. When you encounter the other in an egoistic relationship, where you simply see him as somebody who can satisfy your interest, and that's all. And altruism as the opposite, where it will be the tendency to involve an unwarranted surrender of the self to the interest of the other. There is this tension where other people would simply see their encounter with the other as a way of saying, what can I get from this? And other people will see their encounter with the other as what I call an unwarranted surrender to the interest of the other, to say, look at this poor person or this hungry person, what is it that they can give him? And then a person immediately surrender. Now, there is a tension here, and there are three responses that have been developed, and then I'm going to try and see share them with you. The first one is what is called developed egoism. Basically, developed egoism presumes that I can respond to the other only after I have taken care of my interests. First and foremost, I must take care of my interest, I must be alive, I must be strong, and then I can go into the swimming pool and save that person. Otherwise, if I myself am not strong and so on, how am I going to go in the first place even attempt to do that? Now, it's not what we call crass egoism, which simply looks at anybody as a way of satisfying interest. It's what we call developed egoism. It still say, first and foremost, I must be alive, and thereafter I can see that I can do that. The alternative to that is what is called also maybe developed altruism, which is the willingness to transcend the concerns of the self for the sake of the other. What is sometimes called the radical self-giving or self-denial, like in the New Testament, where they say that unless you lose your life, you may, you or first lose your life, then you can gain it. And so it is the opposite of the other, in the sense that it is also saying that I am interested in gaining my life, but I must first lose it. Whereas the other says that I'm interested in saving somebody's life, but I must first gain my life. So it depends on what that. Now, the third option that people are giving is what is called legitimate egoism, which is basically an apology for egoism, which says that it is the notion that I too have rights, which balance the rights of the other. That actually I've got my own legitimate interests, even if the other has claims on my me, but I too have legitimate interests, and then they are balanced. So I must therefore search for a balance of the rights that the one has on me with my own rights. Now, having said this, we notice that the first thing is that in the place where our obligation to the other originates is in the interaction, the impact of the encounter with the other. That is the place where our moral obligation originates is in the that it is only in relation to the other that I can responsibly determine what is good for me, or what goodness is to begin with. In the absence of my interaction with the other, I may not even know what is actually good in life. This is a new way of beginning to look at morality, at life, what one can say in a more humble, with some acceptance of humility, to say that I do not know on my own. I must first interact with other people in order to actually know what is good for me. And it is relevant in the context of interracial, intercultural situations, because then you are not going to be what normally is referred to as an imperialistic way of imposing wealth systems, your own wealth systems, to others. But you'll simply be saying, this is my wealth system, and am I not doing violence by imposing it on the other people? Can't I first check what does the other person think about it? And then I can know, in that context of the interaction, what is actually good, what is right, and so on and so on in life. Now, my interest is on this whole debate about the tension between egoism and altruism. Of course, there are people who say that no person can be wholly altruistic in life. There are people who say that you cannot be wholly altruistic in life, that whether you like it or not, you are going to have some element of self-regard. It may not be self-interest or egoism in that sense, but some element of self-regard. And so that is why other people refer to what I called developed egoism as also rationalized egoism. Now, I would like to conclude by reading with you one of the texts that I used in part of this lesson, which is that an open relationship is not really common, and where it does occur, it occurs for a very brief moment. Actually, Martin Buber is saying that a real genuine relationship of an encounter between a self and a self, or an I, if it lasts long, the two people who are involved will get tired of it. And it struck me as very strange, because basically most of our marriage relationships are based on open, what you may call naked selfness. That I can truly be engaged in a married partnership with a person if I am really myself with my weaknesses and strength and everything. Now, but he says that actually, even at that level, those moments where I'm really myself are of necessity going to be brief, because I'm encountering another person. I cannot wholly surrender myself. And therefore, that the I and the I relationship, a person, it cannot be for a long, permanent relationship. Rather, it cannot be there for them. At some point, you're going to see that person purely as the mother of your children and the wife and so on, and no longer as that person, as the self. Now, he says that this, however, is the sublime melancholy of our Lord, that every you must become an it in our world. However exclusively present it may have been in the direct relationship, as soon as the relationship has run its course or is permeated by means, the you becomes an object amongst objects, possibly the noblest and yet one of them, assigned its measure and boundary. The actualization of work involves loss of actuality. And he says, genuine contemplation never lasts long. A genuine, genuine contemplation, it never lasts long. And even love cannot persist in direct relation. It endures, but only in the alternation of actuality and latency. The human being who, but now, was unique and devoid of qualities, not at hand, but only present, not experienceable, only touchable, has become a he or she, an aggregate of qualities, a quantum with a shape. That human being who just a little while ago was the person has suddenly just become an aggregate of qualities or a quantum with a shape. But as long as I can do, as I can do that, he is my you no longer and not yet again. That is that. Can we have your response? This has been too abstract. I think part of the importance is to get a sense of what happens. How do I become a self in interacting? How do I really become a self? And the idea is in interaction with other people. Now, I think it's an important base to recognize or to begin to gain the value of appreciating our humanness being formed in the context of people who are unlike us. The tension between otherness, sameness, and humanness.
It strikes me that independent of other people, we're still a self. I guess that's where I come from. But when we move in community, then that self evolves in relationship to other people. And I think it can become more vital. Certainly the polarization that occurs between people generates more than either of them was originally. In other words, the sum of the whole is greater than the individual parts. And I think that's very, very true in relationship. But even as independents, you know, the hermits of the world who go out and sit on their mountaintop, there's still a self out there, you know, who has a capability of expressing him or herself, and is evolving in a way apart from community, but in a way which is just as valid for them, you know, as the people who have moved into community and are gaining the benefits of community. But I think once we move in community, all the mechanisms that you're talking about become extremely important. the recognition of equality of each individual and the sanctity of the selves that are walking around in other people. You know, it becomes extremely important so that we can function together and grow more than what we were originally.
I couldn't help but think when you were talking about how to get where you're talking about, there has to be, like you say, the hermits. Well, there's people who live in communities, live with families, who isolate themselves so much that they're a hermit within their own busy world. They don't allow themselves to see the differences of maybe the person who lives next door and they look the same color or go to the same church or anything, but they still don't allow themselves to see that difference that exists between themselves and that other person. They just, they intentionally don't want to deal with that. They become a hermit within themselves.
The whole thing about community and being yourself in a community, I was thinking about my different communities. I have a community here that is wonderful every time we come here. My communities at home are one community at church, and I am myself that way. Another community is that I have two daughters in two different schools, and I'm very active in both their schools, and I'm very different in there. I mean, the relationships I have are very different. And in those communities, I feel very frustrated because I have very close friends in some of those communities and some more distant, but my close friendships, we have the same goals as far as what we want for our children to experience in school. But as far as a Christian goal, I'm the only one that has that for my children in that community, and I find that most frustrating as a Christian person, for my close friends in that community to not have those goals. And they're very clear about not wanting those goals. They're very good people, and they have very wonderful families with good ethical things, but not Christian, and deaf and very outspoken. A few times I express my Christianity, and they completely close me off and say, some of them have grown up in a Christian family and have totally rejected it as adults. And that is just it's becoming more frustrating all the time. And I feel like I can't be who I am because it's shut off. I don't know if anybody else experiences that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, it struck me when you said that. There is a revealed self. And it seems to be a product of community ethics, that we move into. And I think you're going to move into that ethical relationship. But we are in a Christian ethic community, ethically based community here. And what is acceptable within this community, as we move out into the secular world, it doesn't become acceptable. The issue of the separation of church and state, within many of the organizations that are public domain, becomes a real issue, and you can't deal with your Christian beliefs under those conditions.
Even with friends.
Yeah.
As you can see, that the basis of this line of argument of how do you deal with the other has been really more on humanistic grounds, and most of the scholars are Jewish scholars who are not necessarily Christian. Now, it's different if you approach it as a Christian, because then you are to use certain presuppositions that are not only rational or humanistic, but that are also what you may call gospel based. And that is where now you come to what does it mean to encounter a person as part of understanding yourself as also as part of that that individual who is a sojourner in this world. In other words, who is not really, this world doesn't belong to you. In the same way that this other also is not his home, in the sense that we are an eschatological community, in the sense that we are those who are called to live as witnessing that which is to come, which is greater than this. Now, that is completely different. You are basing, it will be an ethics or say a response to the impact of the other on the basis now of following Jesus specifically or of the gospel. But now this one is purely what is common to everybody. That the other, when you encounter the other, if truly that other is a person, he is a center of meaning, he impacts you on certain obligations, which means that you can fight on issues, there can be a conflict, but it also means that you can open yourself and learn, you can get into his world and begin to understand why he does things the way he does, you can defend yourself, etc., etc. So there are a number of things that happens with him. It's like going to fight with a boxer. You do not know how he fights. You test him and so on until you are satisfied that, well, he has got dangerous left hooks. So you go ahead and knowing that always you have protected your left chin because he's dangerous that side.
You said that the one way that you encounter people is that we would look at them as being less, something less.
Yes.
It seems to me, though, that it also works the other way, which causes a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. I know there are times where I have kicked myself partway into a conversation or into a first encounter with a person because I realize that suddenly I am thinking of myself as less,
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and I am exalting them. And
exactly.
And if I can avoid that, if I can speak to them feeling as an equal,
exactly.
my conversation relationship with that person is much better than when I am kind of in awe and think, oh my gosh, should I be talking to this person, etc.
Yes.
I think it's a lot easier to do the children at that level of meeting the other, because even when they have some preconceived notion of what sort of type of person you like, they don't think of that when they're dealing with you. You're just whoever you are. And so, that is their model, and that is your model. Who you are is what they see, and then they get kind of new ideas of what people are like. And I think that was, for me, when I was in Botswana, one of the greatest things that I felt I did was just to be me and show them that not all whites are a certain way, because I was like that. I was just me, and I could deal with my kids in the classroom as me, and they accepted me as me, not as just a white teacher.
I think that it is very easy to, as you mentioned, the issue of when you encounter the other person as a you yourself, taking yourself to be lower. It is a reality which happens, and it's one of the embarrassing things which happens to people who have been especially held lower or made to believe they are lower for a long time, as it happens to many black people, especially in our country. But I think that the responsibility, or rather the incidence of a person who believes it, or who is made to grow up accepting that he is himself, he must rate, for that person to lower himself to the level of a person who approaches him as lower, it must be difficult. Which is where I said that once you you take yourself to be a full mature adult, you know, you can ask direct questions and expect an answer. And suddenly you encounter a person who is adult but responds, reacts to you like a child. Now, whether will that make you to revert to his level, that takes courage. That is where I say that if you encounter an equal, he may actually be judgmental to you. He may remind you that you have got power. How are you using it? Are you in a position to relinquish it to be at his level? Or are you going to enjoy that position and therefore begin to be boss or what? It requires courage for a person to move from top to lower.
You know, something that's helpful is, I guess, with Bernie's parent, adult, child that resides within each one of us. And, you know, this kind of thing is going constantly on, you know, within each of us. And I'm sure as a conversation with somebody evolves, you feel in tapping your parent, you know, you become righteous parent, or you compute at adult level, or you respond as child, you know, to somebody else. And as what you're saying is, if it is one, you know, like so, hey, we'll all have fun doing it. If it starts cross-transacting, you know, parent to child, and child to parent, you know, then we can end up with some real negative things occurring, and particularly if you get angry child starting to scream and yell, you know, it can get really kind of violent. But the communication is very dynamic. And within us, when we're online, within communication, all these factors are constantly rolling over and have to be coped with, and it's not easy. And it happens regardless of race or gender, you know, all this stuff makes communications extremely difficult. It's amazing we get through as well as we do, I think.
Doesn't society kind of condition us to put on that protection when we meet someone new?
I think so.
Meet them on that basis in the beginning.
I think especially the more technical society becomes, or this what other people would say, the more urbanized, the more you stay, the more you really are conditioned to always have more masks. But people who, for example, grow up in a community where you know everybody from start to finish, they easily become themselves. Their masks are less. They invoke them less. But what Weber is saying is that in life, ordinarily, to be truly self for a long time is impossible. Otherwise, you will not even have the resources to be self where it matters.
Is that a learning process? A conscious learning process?
To
try and meet people on that basis? Or does that come from are we going back to basics when we do that, or is that a form of learning from?
To a very large extent, what this is basically, I think, to some extent, what our religion, or at least our Christian faith, is all about, to try and remind us to be ourselves, and the grace means to be accepted as there are natural, normal human natural defenses that we invoke, but we should actually try to be more selves. And actually, people relate with you trustingly in that respect. And that is why that trust is more special in a marriage relationship, where people are real themselves, than in any other context, where you relate with a person as your brother, sister, or cousin, than as that. The final thing that interests me is this tension that I drew between egoism and altruism, because I think in those conditions or those circumstances where we encounter the other, we have the tendency to relate in two ways. Either to see the other as workers who comes to us, whom we need their services, or we become so, what I call, we empty ourselves like other people, and there are various noble things that people do, like opening your house to the other, so to strangers, or other people can say that, for example, challenging the government to put a budget for such people, as that, which are things which have tensions and abuses. But I'm trying to find out how you relate to, how do you see them? There are what we call extremes in these options, but somehow sometimes there is something that is, as Christians, that becomes what to other people may be regarded as an extreme thing, in truth becomes a noble response as Christians. We will deal with that of hospitality to the stranger, to the those who are vulnerable, on Saturday, as part of our final session. But I think it's still important to know that in our encounter with the other, we can either respond to at the level of legitimate egoism to say that I'll give them what I'm also entitled and what they're also entitled. That's an apologetic way. Or one would make a developed egoism in the sense that I'll give them their due after I've taken care of for myself. Or the other way around, the legitimate altruism, which says that
I think so much of this has to do with how much you are connected to yourself as well as God, or how much you understand yourself and your actions, your beliefs, your values. And because I think so much happens unconsciously when you encounter another one. I don't know, I just wanted to throw that out, that I think there's so much going on unconsciously. It takes a lot of effort to overcome that, or to consciously then be aware of how you are interacting with other people and what is going on. Is this egoism? Is it altruism?
When we're talking about egoism and altruism, I can't think of... can't help but think of, you know, Matthew 5-7. Jesus tells us so many things that are obviously asking us to reject egoism and to follow a way of extreme altruism. You know, if someone asks you to walk 1 mile, walk 2. Mm-hmm. And we have a way of of living in the world and completely accepting the values of our secular society. And so what we will do is we will take care of ourselves, but we will be a Christian with what's left over. Mm-hmm. Something, you know, we will consider tithing if we are making as much as we want to make. Mm-hmm. And we will consider tithing if it fits into our budget. It seems to me that if someone chooses to be a follower of Christ and be very observant, try to live the life that is there, then it's a radical rejection of all kinds of egoism. And that Christ tells us to die to ourselves, and Paul picks this up, you know, it talks about a daily dying. I think we have plenty of there, we have plenty of text to work with. And that living out, when you were talking about your non-Christian friends, I would think that, you know, we're called to go ahead and be just as Christian to them as we are to our Christian friends. And that is how you are. You seem to, people echoed your frustration with, you know, that you want to be a Christian, and well, you know, you have to be a Christian, but you can't just tell them what you are as a Christian. You have to show them. And that is the only way to perhaps do evangelism to people who have left the church, is they have to see in your life something that they want in theirs.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I think the important thing what summarize is that I often think that I don't know whether people think it's unfortunate that God makes us encounter the other, or whether is it part of the gracious mercy of God that we have this opportunity, because it's unsettling to encounter the other. It's not a smooth encounter. It's conflictual. It's threatening. It's shocking. It's shaking your system of values. And do you think it's a good opportunity that you'd become a different, more gracious person, or do you think it's an unnecessary pain, etc.? These are some of the things that I think people should look into more seriously. What are the implications of the other? How simple life would have been if all of us were the same, but would it be richer? would it have been richer? Would we have matured by learning how to deal with people who are radically different from us? And all these things, I think, are some of the good things that we fail to see and even make use of. I believe personally would be much poorer.